This is Charlotte Talks, and I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, let's try this. Woo! Charlotte filmmaker Rory Karp is here to discuss his new documentary. Nature Boy debuted this month on ESPN as part of the network's 30 for 30 series. Nature Boy tells the story of Ric Flair, the pro wrestler who turned his fast-talking, faster-living fantasy into a real-life success story and a cycle of self-destruction that nearly killed him. Flair lives in Atlanta now, but called Charlotte home during his glory years in the 1980s and 1990s. The documentary covers all aspects of Flair's roller coaster existence, and we'll talk this hour with Rory about how he got into some of those difficult subjects. Rory Karp, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thanks for having me.
So you grew up, I think, in Philadelphia, big wrestling fan, and you saw Ric Flair wrestle when you were a young boy. Let's just start there. What do you remember about the first time you saw Ric Flair in person?
Well, I remember he came to a place called the Civic Center in North Philadelphia, and the WWF came to the Spectrum, where Rocky fought in the movie. And the Spectrum was by no means a luxurious place, but it was like a palace Taj Mahal compared to the Civic Center. I mean, the Civic Center was basically a place to house human beings, and there was like one bathroom. And my dad took me when I was 8 years old to see the NWA. Ric Flair was wrestling in the main event. And I kind of weaseled my way down to the aisle where the wrestlers came out because I was so little, I could kind of maneuver my way through. And Ric Flair came down the aisle, and I stuck out my four fingers and gave him a woo. And he noticed me because I was so young and there really weren't many kids there. And he looked right at me, and I'll always remember what he said. He looked at me and he said, "Don't you ever woo at me, you little brat."
and you were one for life.
That was it for me. I loved being put down by him. And I said, "Man, one day, 30 years from now, I'm going to make a movie about you, you jerk." So it kind of just started from there. And I loved professional wrestling as a kid. I just kind of fell in love with the whole escapism and like alternate reality of this world where you could be so outrageous and there was these colorful characters. And I based my friendships in elementary and middle school off of other kids who liked wrestling and whose parents would drive us to the matches. that was basically how I based my whole friendships, you know? It's like, hey, my parent is a white supremacist. I'm like, but do they like wrestling? That's what I need to know. So I understand that they're deeply flawed human beings, but will they drive us to Philadelphia to see wrestling? So, and I kind of just went from there, and I've always stayed a fan for the most part.
And when you were younger particularly, did you think that most of what you were seeing was real?
You know, you knew something was up. You just weren't sure what. I mean, I didn't think it was legitimate fighting going on. I saw that when you would wrestle with your friends that, you know, you have to kind of just not resist to let some of these things happen. But there was a kind of like, it was like a magic show. You know when you see David Copperfield, he's not really disappearing, or David Blaine's not really levitating or whatever, but you're just not sure how they do it. And I think that was kind of the magic of it. It's like, how are they doing it? Do they not like each other? Are they friends? There was still a real mystery about it back then that doesn't really exist today.
So fast forward many years, you're a documentary filmmaker, and you're working on an ESPN 30 for 30 about the 1990s Duke basketball anti-hero Christian Laettner. You throw in a soundbite from Ric Flair discussing how to portray a villain, and it attracts a lot of attention on social media. How does that wind up leading to a two-year project that turns into Nature Boy?
You've done your research pretty well here. Well, ESPN noticed that he was getting a big reaction online, and he was really just in one interview bite, and there were a lot of pop culture-like figures in that film. And I had been pushing them for a long time about doing something on wrestling, and they were really just fixated on Andre the Giant. They just thought like he was like the be-all, end-all to do a film on. And I had mentioned Ric Flair, and they said, "Hey, are you still interested in doing something on him?" And I'm like, "Yes, I think he's a very multi-layered, multifaceted personality." And probably the biggest thing about Ric that's really interesting is he's very relevant today. You know, his heyday was like the 80s and early 90s, but athletes are wearing his cleats. They're quoting him. He's rap stars are writing songs about him. Post Malone, you strike me as a big Post Malone. Post Malone, you know, he's
how
like,
did you know?
He's like 22 years old, and he just did a rap song about Rick. And I mean, he's got songs on YouTube that have like 500 million views. So he was almost ahead of his time in a way, and I found that really interesting that he was relevant now for what he did in the 1980s, and ESPN liked that too.
Yeah, for those who don't know, those who probably never read the infamous 2011 story by Shane Ryan and Grantland, which was part of ESPN, Ric Flair has had, you know, endless problems away from wrestling, you know, the violence, abuse, adultery, steroid, drug, alcohol abuse. I mean, this in a lot of ways is a very sad story. How did you balance that with, you know, the fun, the cartoon aspect of wrestling?
Well, a lot of the stories he tells are really humorous. It's crazy. But, you know, he's talking about exposing himself on airplanes, and it's funny. He kind of has like – you can kind of see how he got away with it because he's so charming. Now, I want to make a distinction. He's no like Harvey Weinstein or Kevin Spacey, or he's not he's never – to my knowledge, ever forced himself on anyone or had any kind of accusation like that. But he was somebody who's extremely promiscuous and like you said, had some major problems. And I think what we tried to do in the film is show the counterbalance of that. You know, while he's laughing about all this and these are great stories, you know, he has a family at home that's suffering. And he talks about in the film that he always wanted to be the man. And that's like very revered in our culture today for a lot of people. You know, I'm the best. I'm the greatest. Look how awesome I am. People post on Facebook how awesome their lives are. The president of the United States always tell you how great he is. So Rick, he kind of was at the forefront of that, of being the man. He said he could never live with being a man. A man is just an ordinary guy, you know, who does the ordinary family activities, takes care of your kids, takes them to carpool, goes to the PTA meetings. Nobody applauds for you when you walk in the PTA meeting, believe me. So that's kind of like the yin and yang. And, you know, Rick paid the ultimate price. You mentioned some of the – he had some legal problems, some financial problems. But he actually – you know, he lost his son to a drug overdose, and his son kind of emulated his lifestyle. And what bigger price can you pay than that? And we really detail that in the film.
The Nature Boy starts with Rick telling the audience about those glory days you just mentioned.
The 1980s was the perfect time for wrestling, and I was the perfect wrestler for the 1980s.
I'm the best there is! I am Ric Flair!
Wrestling was my love.
No one has ever done it better than the Nature Boy.
Bright lights, big cities, pretty ladies, Nature Boy!
The Nature Boy wasn't a wrestling character. The Nature Boy wasn't fake. The Nature Boy was me.
That sequence, and also when we see Ric Flair in the current interviews that he did with you and your crew, reminded me, I mean, I know it's such an obvious comparison, but the 2008 movie The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke, there's a scene where Mickey Rourke and Marissa Tomei, who plays his girlfriend, is kind of this burned-out strip dancer. They're singing in a bar. It's an 80s hair metal band, and they're talking about how awful the 90s are. And just, you know, there's a lot of kind of, man, things were better then. And I just wonder how much those stories paralleled for you as you were going through making this documentary.
Yeah, well, there's a scene in our film where Rick gets back body dropped on thumbtacks. He's like 60 years old at this point, and they're real thumbtacks, and they're embedded in his back. And it reminded me of the Mickey Rourke scene. Remember, he has like staples in his back, and I think there's it's natural to kind of parallel that, you know. And I think some people could look at Rick's story and see tragedy, but others can see glory. I think it's both, to be honest with you. He's kind of a two-sided coin, and I find that most subjects are kind of shades of gray. You know, it's not always so black and white. Like it's not usually like wrestling where there's a good guy and a bad guy. Kind of, he kind of rides the middle. So there's definitely some tragic aspects of Rick's life for sure. But at the same time, he's given people a whole lot of joy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, me included. I mean, and that level of escapism. And I would find myself when I would work on the film, I edited the first cut of it. And I lost so much time just watching the footage and being entertained by him. He was a great talker, very talented. So, but to get back to your original point, yes, for sure. I think if you watch the movie The Wrestler, you could see some parallels with Rick.
And I remember when that movie came out, he did some interviews, I think locally, where he in essence said, you know, he's not that guy. But I'm wondering if, you know, after you go through this, is that maybe a case of, you know, you can't have the perspective that maybe other people do have it?
Well, I mean, he's incredibly revered. I mean, people really do look up to him, and he has a relationship with his daughter. The Mickey Rourke character has no relationship with his daughter. The Mickey Rourke character has like a side job, like working in a deli and is wrestling independent shows. I mean, Ric Flair pulls in a good amount of coin doing autograph sessions. So I don't think it's really that fair, you know. I mean, in the last scene,
one's a movie, one's real life.
Right, right. But I do think there's some aspects of it for sure that, you know, a lot of stuff that's been done on wrestling up to this point, because I am a fan. I would watch anything done on wrestling, and a lot of it was what were well-done documentaries, but they usually fell into two categories. Very, very tragic, like just a tragedy. Like, isn't this sad? Isn't wrestling just the underbelly of society? Or it was something that really skimmed the surface, and it was like a reporter saying, like, how do you do a body slam? And it was just very basic. And I wanted to dig deep, but at the same time, I just didn't want it to just be all doom and gloom. This is not just a story about Ric Flair. It's a story about wrestling as entertainment. And even if you're not a wrestling fan, you know, NASCAR is really big in Charlotte. I'm not a big NASCAR fan, but I've done films on it, and I can appreciate the entertainment aspect of it, the work ethic. And hopefully this is what viewers will get in this film about wrestling. And I wanted this to be a little bit of a homage to, in my view, the sport of wrestling.
Again, I'm speaking with Rory Karpf. He is the director of the new 30 for 30 documentary about Ric Flair. It's called Nature Boy, and Rory lives here in Charlotte. I want to ask you, even though, you know, as you said, it's not all doom and gloom. There's plenty of glory and entertainment and happiness. But I do want to ask you, one of the more serious parts of the documentary is when you talk a little bit about life on the road, or his life on the road.
Then, so how much do you drink a day? I said, I'll drink at least 10 beers and probably 5 mixed drinks. He said, well, how many days a week do that? I said, every day. He said, What do you mean every day? I said, I work every day. I drink the beer in the car, I get to the hotel, and I drink vodka. He came out of his chair like that. You drink every day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and you've been doing that for how long? I said, well, let me say, it's 1989. I started in 72. You do the math, almost 20 years. He said, that's not possible. We said, oh, yeah, it is.
We're going to do the math. We'll be right back after a break with Rory Karpf, and we're going to talk a little bit about that clip with Ric Flair. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins on Charlotte Talks.
Back to Charlotte Talks in just a moment on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Our support comes from WFAE members and Alpine Ski Center, outfitting skiers and snowboarders with performance outerwear, accessories, and snow sport gear for all ages. Alpine is open every day until Christmas. And Doctors Making House Calls, physician-owned and managed, Doctors Making House Calls works to help complex patients stay healthy at home and avoid unnecessary ER visits and hospitalizations. Details available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. Tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, Tommy Tomlinson. The former Charlotte Observer columnist was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. One of this country's great writers, because of his gift for storytelling, he's now producing a podcast for WFAE, focusing on telling our story through a series of intimate interviews. Southbound launches on Wednesday, but we spend an hour with Tommy Tomlinson talking about this new venture and more tomorrow on Charlotte Talks at 9, here on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, President Trump pitches his America First trade policy in Asia. We'll look at what's really going on with U.S.-China trade and beyond. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg, I'm in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Rory Karpf. He is the director of the new ESPN 30 for 30 documentary, Nature Boy. It's about Ric Flair and his life in and out of the wrestling ring. And before we went to the break, we played the clip of Ric Flair talking about his very heavy drinking and that reflected really, though, a life on the road. I think at one point in the documentary, he says, you know, basically for 20 plus, maybe longer than that, 20 plus years, he just wasn't home. So tell me a little bit about what you learned in terms of the toll of this kind of occupation.
Well, he loved it. In the film, his first wife says he was just miserable when he would come home. And that kind of goes back to that whole yin and yang of the man versus a man. You know, it's interesting. We had screenings of the film in movie theaters. And I'm always interested in how people react to things. And people were hysterical laughing at some of his stories of, talking about sleeping with 10,000 women and drinking, all the drinking he's been doing. And the more I worked on it, I find it kind of sad, you know, that he couldn't be monogamous. Like, why? You know, and I ask him in the film, why couldn't you just go back to your hotel room and watch TV? He couldn't be by himself. There's a real aspect that he doesn't like himself, I think, or there must be some deep-seated hole inside himself that needs to be filled constantly. That's what I've found with celebrities or actors or athletes that have to always be entertaining, always be on. There's just a void there. And you know, I mean, I'm sure it's funny when he says 10,000 women and it's like, but you know, the guy was married. He wasn't single.
Right.
So it's,
several times and with kids.
Yeah. But I mean, he had two pretty long marriages. I think his first one was like 10 years or so. And then the second one was about 20 some years. So, you know, I'm not in his house and everybody has their own truth and their own moral code, I guess, you know. I don't know if there was some sort of open relationship, but it's just, I don't know. I found a sadness to it. And I know he is in a monogamous relationship now for over 5 years, as far as I know. And, you know, the guy's 68 years old. And I guess you have to slow down at some point. He didn't have a choice this time. So
I wondered also what you thought, because it really stood out to me, and I'm sure this was intentional, you know, some of the shots, the camera angles. When you just look at him physically, his eyes are rheumy, his face is a little splotched. Now, obviously, he's gotten older. His walk, it has a hitch in it. These are things, obviously, some of the things he did away from wrestling, but being a wrestler, I mean, the scars, the blood, just, you know, what was it like to really see that up close? You'd been a fan, but you hadn't seen it like that before.
He's taken a lot of abuse in the ring. He was the champion, but he was known for kind of taking punishment. He was the bad guy, so he would lose most of the match and then kind of cheat at the end and win. But, I mean, he was flying all over the ring, and you see it, and he does have a genetic gift. I think you either have that kind of disposition to not be injured, and he was not injured very much throughout his career. But I think it's actually his hard living he's done outside the ring that's taken more of its toll. I mean, a few months ago, his body just kind of shut down. I mean, think about how much he said he drank. I mean, right. 15 drinks every single day. That's a lot of alcohol.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you mentioned he had a near-death experience, it was reported, right? I mean, he was in pretty serious condition.
Right. In August, he was admitted into the hospital. They put him in a medically induced coma, and I think they gave him less than a 20% chance to live. So it was not looking good. In fact, I mean, people close to him were telling me this isn't looking good. And we were, you know, first and foremost, I was concerned for him as a friend. But then you got to think, well, we got to change the end of the movie.
Right,
if he
right.
passes away. And then I started thinking, well, are we going to film his funeral? Like, what, you know, how does this work exactly? So luckily he did pull through, but it was touch and go for a while.
You interviewed the rapper Snoop Dogg, who preceded Post Malone. And you've done a documentary about Snoop Dogg, actually, and some of his involvement in youth football. But in the Nature Boy, Snoop Dogg talks about how much the hip-hop crowd, African-Americans in general, have embraced Ric Flair's promos and kind of his signature cry.
That's why I'm wearing lizard shoes and a Rolex watch, and I got a limousine sitting out there a mile long with 25 women just dying for me to go, woo! They all want to be like the Nature Boy, but there can only be one. We are the Horsemen, and the bottom line is we are all night long.
Why do you think this, his whole act, his whole persona is so popular in 2017 when, you know, if you went through the list of popular wrestlers from the 80s, nobody really remembers the catchphrases. I mean, not, you know, just in general. So what is it about Ric Flair?
I think it just goes back to that being the man culture, that that's in hip hop, you know, that's having the most girls and the most bling. That's they're still rapping about that. And athletes, too, talking about scoring the most touchdowns and having the most swag and looking the most fly. He was doing all that in the 80s. Hulk Hogan wasn't talking about that. He was talking about saying your prayers and eating your vitamins. And he just wasn't as cool. Ric Flair's just cool. I mean, he just has something about him, from the platinum blonde hair to his Rolex watch to all his catchphrases. He just kind of has that it factor. He's just very, very entertaining. And it's funny you mentioned Snoop Dogg. I've done actually 4 series with Snoop Dogg.
Oh, wow. I'm sorry.
No. It's I just bring it up because he's a guy that maybe like Rick a little bit, that we were talking one time about marriage, and I really consider him a good friend. And he was telling me about his marriage problems and that, like, for a period of time, he was a pimp. And I was like, oh, yeah, you got a lot of girls. He goes, no, I was literally a pimp. Like, I literally had women working for me. And I'm like, I could see how that could be a detriment to your marriage, for sure. But he kind of has reformed and seems to have a really solid marriage and is such a – like, in one hand, I'll see him go off on someone on Instagram cursing and yelling. And then with me, he's got such a kind nature, and with children – and he's kind of has a different side to him as well, kind of like Rick in a way. And they're kind of similar in that nature. I mean, Snoop's incredibly giving. I don't know if Rick is as giving as Snoop is, but with charity and kids and that kind of thing. But and Snoop actually texted Ric Flair when he was in the hospital.
Oh, he did?
On him. Yeah, they're friendly. They're friendly. So it's kind of cool. I visited Rick when he was in the hospital.
What was that like? Because that's much different than being the documentary interviewer.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it was actually it was kind of sad, but I mean, it was really neat too, because it was just him and I, and there were no heirs. You know, like when somebody's in the hospital and, you know, they're at their most vulnerable. You know, he's stared death in the eye. And I was very honored that he even wanted me to visit him, because he knows a lot of people. And we, like, really hung out. Like, he talked to my son on the phone. I have an 11-year-old son who just happened to call me. And he goes, let me talk to your son real quick. And I was like, why does he want to talk to my son? My son doesn't even like wrestling. So he was like, hey, I'm with your dad. I just want to let you know, you should be really proud of him. He's a really good man. And that was really touching. And then, like, I held Rick's hand a little bit. He told me he loved me. I mean, it was really nice. I got to see a very different side of him in that moment. Just kind of – he wasn't acting like the Nature Boy. We were just, like, watching football and eating pizza and kind of discussing life. It's a shame we weren't filming that. That would have been cool.
Always thinking about the next movie. I'm wondering, you know, what – does he think of the film. I'm sure, I think you've mentioned you went out to Comic-Con with him. This was before he got sick. But has he had time to kind of reflect on this since he's come out of the hospital and what the movie means as it's about to premiere on ESPN?
Yeah, man. I mean, I don't know. It's interesting. Like, I'll talk to other documentary filmmakers and in our community, and they'll sometimes they're kind of like don't want to get close to their subjects because they don't want to be biased. But my point of view is, like, I like having a friendship because I think when you're friends with somebody, they'll be more open with you. And sometimes a friend, a real friend, will give you a hard truth. They're not just going to sugarcoat everything for you. And that's how I try to view it. So with Rick, we had a relationship of trust where I asked him to trust me. I told him from the beginning, this isn't just going to be this homage to your life and whitewashed. It's going to have the good. I wanted to stress that, the good, but also some of the bad and the ugly. And to his credit, he got that. And he never asked me to change anything. And there's some tough things for him to hear in this film. And it's not like they come from, like, his enemies. They're coming from, like, his children. They're coming from his coworkers, the people that he respects and admires and loves. So that had to be incredibly difficult for him. And even just seeing old footage of him and his son together when his son's a little boy, that, I mean, was very difficult. So, again, I think to his credit, and to the credit of a lot of people I work with, you mentioned the Christian Laettner film. The title of that film was I Hate Christian Laettner.
Right.
And I always remember him calling me up, and he's like, Rory, we got to change the title of the movie. And I'm like, why? I mean, it's fun. He goes, my mom's really upset. And I'm like, your mom's upset.
I'm like, you don't take that call from the mom, by the way.
She left me a 3-minute voicemail explaining to me about how bad I was for saying that about her son, and let her know her son's a good boy and that I'm a bad boy for saying that. But to Christian's credit, he trusted me, and Rick did too. And Christian's mom, I did go over her house and told her, just relax here a little bit and let it come out. And then she sent me a really nice card and said she was happy. You know, I'm fortunate. Like, I have not, knock on wood, had any bad experiences making a film. Usually people are pretty happy in the end, and I've told some tough stories. You know?
Again, you're listening to the voice of Rory Karpf. He is a documentary filmmaker. He lives right here in Charlotte, and his latest project is called Nature Boy. It's part of the ESPN 30 for 30 series, premiered on ESPN this month. You can also find it at ESPN.com. You can stream it on the ESPN app. You mentioned some of the tougher aspects. One of the decisions you made in this film was to obtain and play the 911 tape, I believe, of Ric Flair when he finds his son's unresponsive body. And his son died at age 25 in 2013 here in Charlotte. Take me through the process of why you ultimately decided to include that.
Well, it's very real. It happened. And it's incredibly raw and gritty. And I kind of just go back to that whole paying the price. You know, a lot of people bring up Rick's problems. Like, somebody asked me in an interview, like, why didn't you delve more into his financial problems? I'm like, well, he had financial problems for sure, but a lot of athletes have financial problems. A lot of entertainers do. He lost his son, and he was there. And I think when you hear that phone call, you really get a sense of the pain and anguish. I mean, what is worse to go through in your life? What more of a price can you pay? And, you know, it's documented in the film. His son wanted to be him. And, you know, just like there's only one Michael Jordan had sons that played basketball, but they weren't Michael Jordan on the court. There's only one Ric Flair. And he had a disposition to be able to party like that that his son didn't, and his son lost his life.
The, I guess, maybe not a counter, but a sort of a silver lining, if you will, that you go through. And people, I don't follow wrestling, so I just didn't realize. I was vaguely aware that Ric Flair had a daughter who wrestled. I didn't realize she was at a championship level. And you go through in the movie how that in some ways has given him a little bit of comfort and peace as he's gotten older. Just tell us a little bit about Ashley Flair and how she wound up being the heir to her father when it comes to wrestling.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Rick had 4 children in total. His oldest is a daughter, Megan, never got involved with wrestling. Then he had a son, David, still with his first wife. David tried to get involved in wrestling and just didn't have it. just didn't have the charisma and was kind of living in his dad's shadow. Then there's Reed and Ashley from his second wife. And Reed tried to get into wrestling. And he had some charisma, but, you know, and then there's the daughter, Ashley, who I believe was like a personal trainer. And she had a lot of troubles too, kind of growing up, as she says, in a dysfunctional household. And she had been married twice, and she's talked about this before. So I think Reed was kind of pushing her to get involved in wrestling and do wrestling. And then when he passed away, I think she decided to go all in and go for it and kind of dedicate her life to it. And at the same time, I think it was a wake-up call in a way that she had these vices, kind of like her brother and her dad did too. Drugs and alcohol, and she kind of made wrestling her addiction. I mean, she will tell you, I think, that she's obsessed with it. And she really is special. And it's kind of unusual because she's the daughter, wasn't ever really expected to be much, but she is an incredible athlete, probably one of the best athletes on the entire roster right now. Very charismatic. And, you know, Rick talks about in the film, I think Hulk Hogan says it, that Rick's number one love is wrestling. That's his lady, ultimately. Well, his daughter is like the champion. So think about what they get to share together. They both have this love. Their number one love is wrestling. And I think it's really brought them close together. I think that Rick probably related to the girls a little easier, being the dad and whatnot, and maybe not putting expectations on them like he did his sons. But now that she's wrestling, I mean, I know they talk every single day, and it's really been a joy for him. He says it, that he lives vicariously through her. And at the same time, she probably gets this attention from her dad and gets to talk to him. And what better person to talk to about wrestling than the greatest ever? So it's pretty neat that it wrestling, in a way, kind of tore his family apart, and now has brought he and his daughter close together.
And I should mention, Ashley Flair, her wrestling name is Charlotte, so that's yet another example of how closely the Flairs are tied to Charlotte, even though he now lives in Atlanta. What's your theory about why he ultimately wound up in Atlanta and no longer is in Charlotte?
Well, I think his son died here, so it's painful. And he ran pretty wild around here, so maybe it was a good escape. I know that his fiance lives in Atlanta too, so I believe he went to be with her and probably escape a lot of painful memories here.
Again, we're speaking with Rory Karp. He's the director of Nature Boy, which is a new ESPN 30 for 30 documentary about the life and times of Ric Flair. You mentioned Hulk Hogan a few times, and he's interviewed, obviously, in your film. One of the interesting things is you're sort of painting the picture of these two characters is Ric Flair says at one point, Hulk Hogan was selling vitamins and milk. I was selling sex and booze. So when we get back from the break, I want to ask you a little bit more about the dichotomy of the two biggest wrestling stars of the 80s. And we'll also get into a little bit of your other film work, including guys like Tom Cruise and Paul Newman. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins.
More conversation on Charlotte Talks in just a moment here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Our support comes from WFAE members and Taylor Richards & Conger, a specialty shop for men built and headquartered in Charlotte featuring European and American tailored clothing and accessories. Phillips Place next to Dean & DeLuca. Details at trcstyle.com. And the Charlotte Symphony, presenting the magic of Christmas, a holiday family tradition featuring the full orchestra, chorus, and a visit from Santa, November 30th through December 3rd at Belk Theater. Info at charlottesymphony.org. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on Point, President Trump in Asia pitching his America First trade policy. We'll take a look at what's really going on with U.S.-China trade and beyond. That's On Point, coming up at 10, here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE.
Wherever the day's biggest story is unfolding, Morning Edition will connect you to the voices at the center of it all.
Police say a man in a rented Home Depot truck
indictment alleges that Manafort and Gates used... This comes after the Catalan parliament declared independence.
Whether the news is happening close to home or whether it hits close to home, start your day with Morning Edition.
Morning Edition from 5 until 9 on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We are speaking today with Rory Karpf. He is the director of Nature Boy. It's a new ESPN 30 for 30 documentary premiered this month. You can find it at ESPN.com. You can also stream it on the ESPN app. And anyone who watches ESPN knows how much ESPN loves that app. So, Rory, before we broke, I mentioned that quote about Hulk Hogan. He's selling vitamins and milk. And, of course, Ric Flair said he was selling sex and booze. Did that embody kind of the two wrestling series themselves, these two titanic entertainment organizations?
Exactly. Yeah, Hulk Hogan was for kids, as was the WWF in the 1980s. And Rick wrestled for the NWA, which was big around here in North Carolina. And they kind of were more for blue-collar adults, kind of like the NASCAR audience. So they – two different fan bases. And as a kid growing up, you always wondered what would happen if Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair ever wrestled. It used to be on the cover of wrestling magazines, I remember, at the time. But they never could wrestle because the organizations would never even acknowledge each other.
Okay.
It was like the other one never existed.
Just like a DC Marvel kind of thing?
It's exactly what it was like, DC Marvel. And then – but it would be like if – when a wrestler was a free agent, it'd be like if Superman could join the Marvel Universe. And so that's what happened when Rick became a free agent. He actually went to the WWF. And that was in, I think, 1990, 91 maybe. And so he went over there. It was like, finally – this is the match that's going to happen. It would have been better maybe a few years earlier, but still. And then it never happened, like, which was – it's still crazy to me. I bring it up that they never had this big WrestleMania match. And I asked tons of people why, and it's hard to get a straight answer. I think it was because if Rick won, then it's like actually showing the other organization maybe is better than WWF. Okay. But then at the same time, they don't want to make him look bad by losing because he's with WWF now. So they had their match a little later when they were both older, and it wasn't what it could have been.
And it's probably too late now. Is that safe to say? You never know with wrestling or boxing, but is it probably too late?
I'm sure they both would do it for some money, but they wrestled a lot when they were older. I mean, they wrestled when they're like 60 years old and went on tours and wrestled, but it wasn't when they were at their height. It really was like if Tyson could have fought Ali or something like that. So, but it never really happened on the grand stage, which what is WrestleMania.
You know, for all the living here in Charlotte, for many years, they would play Rick saying woo on the, or woo, I should say, on the scoreboard at Panther games. I know they've done it at numerous stadiums around the country. And for all that, I never knew the origins of where that came from, which you have in the movie. Tell that story if you don't mind.
He said he was driving in the car, and the Jerry Lee Lewis song came on, Goodness Gracious, Great Balls of Fire, and he goes, woo, and Rick just decided to start using that kind of like in his promos. And that's what those wrestlers did back then. They just had a hot mic for 5 minutes, and they were told, okay, go out there and sell your match. There was no script writers like there are today, and it was really on you. So Rick, I mean, he has a ton of catchphrases, like to be the man, you got to beat the man, things that I wasn't even attributing to him. And the same stuff that he's getting quoted at by athletes today, like the limousine ride and jet flying, and that's all him. I mean, he kind of made that stuff up. And, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis might have, you know, I listen to the song, he gives like a little woo in the song, he's like, woo. But I mean, Rick did, he really made that all his own. So he's incredibly creative. And sometimes that can get lost. Like his life is so crazy and it has been so crazy that he was so good at what he did. And you don't want to lose that aspect that he had such a strong work ethic. He wasn't like you hear about like a Harvey Weinstein or something. Like he wasn't mixing business with wrestling. It says in the film, you know, he was a functioning alcoholic. He never showed up inebriated. He took wrestling incredibly seriously and wanted to do a great job and did and was so entertaining and really became the benchmark for everyone else.
One of the things that I noticed in the film that was interesting is particularly when you're explaining the rigors of learning how to be a wrestler. Also later when you're going through some of the drinking problems, you use animation. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if that came out of just sort of the natural tie. So many of us, I used the word earlier, you think of wrestling as cartoonish. Well, just tell me a little bit about what went into the thinking there.
Well, there's some really great stories told in the film. And you played the one clip when he's in the psychiatrist's office. And you can go as a filmmaker a couple of different routes. You could try to go like Ken Burns style where you use pictures, but there's just no pictures that illustrate some of these stories. You know, there's not pictures of Rick with 10,000 women. So it's like when he's telling these stories, how do you show it? You could do recreations with actors, which I've done before on projects, but I just didn't feel right having an actor play Ric Flair. So then you're right. Wrestling is a little cartoonish. There was a wrestling cartoon in the 1980s.
Was there?
Yeah, on Saturday mornings. So it seemed like it fit well. And a filmmaking friend of mine, this guy Jim Jordan, he brought up, why don't you use animation? They've done that in 30 for 30s before. And it's been used kind of comically, but also seriously as well. And I'm like, wow, this could really work well. And I reached out to a couple companies. And then I found one that were big wrestling fans, Six Point Harness. And, I mean, they did an incredible job. And what they probably should have charged four times as much, but they didn't. I told them we were on a budget. And I don't know your opinion, but I think the animation really worked out nicely.
Yeah, it did. Let's talk a little bit about some of your other work, because you've done a lot of documentary work over the years, much of it with ESPN. And you mentioned NASCAR earlier. You came here, I believe, first in 2005, here being Charlotte, to do a documentary on Dale Earnhardt that was narrated by Paul Newman.
Right.
How did you get Paul Newman? I mean, we all know he was very much a race car driver himself. That was late in his life, though. How did that project come together?
He loved Dale Earnhardt. It had nothing to do with me. In fact, he just loved racing, which is pretty well documented. And, I mean, he just showed up by himself at the time. It's actually the last project he did.
Where did you do it?
In Connecticut.
In Connecticut, okay.
Near his house.
Okay.
And it was like such an old studio, too. It was like in someone else's house. And he just kind of showed up by himself. And, you know, when you're recording a narration, usually you're in a studio, you press the talkback button. And he was having a hard time hearing me. So he said, just come sit next to me. And I remember he said to me, he's like, you know, this is a hell of a script. He said, except for the bad grammar, poor storytelling. He was making jokes, you know. And
did you tell him your preferred wishbone dressing?
Yeah. No, I mean, well, actually, I was really looking forward. That was like the first like celebrity I got to really work with. And I had a whole thing I wanted to tell him afterwards that I love the movie Nobody's Fool and how great he was in it. And I was like, he was like, you know, he wrapped up. He's like, all right, guys. And I'm like, hey, I just want to tell you, I love this movie, Nobody's Fool. You were so great in it and the character and the complexities. He's just kind of nodding his head. He's like, yep, that was a good film. I got to head to CVS. I got some prescriptions to pick up. I'll see you.
So much for Sully.
Yeah. He was like taking off, you know. So, but he was really cool. And I've been so fortunate to get to work with, like you mentioned, some really big name actors like Kevin Costner and Tom Cruise and Vin Diesel. And it's a real privilege, you know, and they're all pros. People always ask me like, man, who's a jerk? Was this guy a jerk? And I'm like, no, they're not. It's like, it's never, to me at least, the big celebrities. It's like somebody's like PR person or like somebody's like assistant.
<You're> like, that's where the attitude comes
yeah,
in.
Yeah, somebody like that, you know, it's not – the people I've been working with are very professional.
Again, that's Rory Karff. He is the director of Nature Boy, which is the new 30 for 30 documentary about the life and times of Ric Flair. So you came here in 2005. You obviously did the Dale Earnhardt documentary. It's called Dale for anyone who wants to go back and see that. What made you ultimately decide to stay in Charlotte?
Well, I was starting a family, and Charlotte has a pretty low cost of living, but also this was like a great period for NASCAR, and with the success of Dale, I got to work on another NASCAR film, and that was kind of like the history of NASCAR, and Kevin Costner was attached to it, and he did a music video for the film that I got to direct, like he had a band, so like that was a really cool project, and then that led into this other one on Rick Hendrick, who is a really big race team owner. And he had a tragedy that happened, a plane crash. And he lost his son on it, his brother, his nieces. And we did a film kind of about that. Very personal film. Really got to know him well. Still just a sweet, sweet man. And he's friends with Tom Cruise. He got Tom Cruise to be in that film.
I'm like, it all goes back to Days of Thunder.
It does go back. But it's just like, I was like, these NASCAR projects are just keep getting better and better and better. And then I got to do a 30 for 30 after that one on a race car driver named Tim Richmond who died of AIDS. And again, I wasn't really a fan. I don't mean that in a derogatory way of NASCAR, but I appreciated it and then was able to kind of move on to do some other things.
You, I think one of the other films you did was about Wendell Scott, who was the pioneering African-American driver in NASCAR. It's an interesting time right now because, as you probably know, Richard Petty has hired Bubba Wallace Jr., who is an African-American driver, really probably the most prominent African-American in NASCAR.
It's crazy.
Since Wendell Scott. Yeah, just what did you think when you heard that?
I just can't believe how long it's – I mean, we had a black president for two terms, and they still didn't have a black NASCAR driver. I mean – what is going on? And they need a star desperately.
Yes, they do.
I mean, they are in desperate need of a star. Sorry, NASCAR, but you do. I mean, all their big names have left. Dale Jr., Jeff Gordon, Tony Stewart. So, yeah, I don't know what took so long. I really don't.
Is that a future documentary, you think, his experience?
Well, maybe if he's good, you know. I mean, at the end of the day, he's got to win and be successful. That's important. So, I mean, hey, man. People have asked, hey, man, like, would you want to do a documentary on this or that? I'm like, if the check's clear, I'm game, all right? I appreciate your honesty. Yeah, I'll film bar mitzvahs if the price is right. Let's do it.
But, yeah, I mean, just from talking to you, you're always looking, I'm sure. Whether it's you or someone else, when you see something like what happened this football season where the president comes out, basically trashes the NFL, and then a lot of the players in the league and coaches go out on a Sunday and protest, that seems tailor-made for somebody to delve into kind of the wildest weekend in the NFL or something to that effect.
Sure. I've interviewed Donald Trump before.
Have you? What was that like?
Well, this was like when he was like more the apprentice Donald Trump. People kind of forget that for a period of time he was like very non-controversial, pretty beloved, kind of like just this quirky character. So he was cool. I mean, it was 20 minutes of time, but he was friendly to everybody and took a picture and whatnot. But anyway, yeah, for sure. I mean, there's great stories everywhere. You know, I have a series that's also out this month called The Secret History of Comics on AMC.
Oh, so DC Marvel was right up your alley.
Exactly, yeah. And it's airing after The Walking Dead. The first episode airs right after The Walking Dead.
You couldn't get a good lead-in.
November 12th. It's actually called Robert Kirkman's Secret History of Comics. And I'm a producer and director on the series. And it's like, as a kid growing up, what I was interested in is wrestling and comic books. That's it. You know, as you could tell, I scored tons with the girls. But I loved wrestling and comics.
Your parents told you you would never get a job with wrestling and comic books as avocations, and look what happened.
It's true. You know, you mentioned something kind of funny. I'll go talk to high schools or college. I'm in my high school wall of fame.
Are you?
I almost did not graduate from high school. They were not going to let me walk. And I remember the principal saying, what are you going to do with your life? Like she said that so condescending. What are you going to do? So I said, hey, to the kids, if you're peaking in high school, you don't have to peak in high school. Sometimes, like I'm peaking around 40. Like you, that's the time you want to go. So I struggled in high school and then I was able to wind up on the wall of fame. So yeah, for sure. I loved wrestling growing up and my parents thought it was incredibly dumb, I'm sure. And same, and comic books weren't very big back then either.
Right. They weren't always cool. Nerds weren't always cool.
That's true. I mean, now comic books aren't even a niche. Like the biggest movies that come out are comic movies. So everybody likes them more or less. And this series was really a dream. And I got to work on both of them at the same time, the Ric Flair film and the comic book series.
So as you look ahead, you just finished two big projects. Do you already have something in mind? And then secondly, is there any kind of wish list out there of subjects?
Well, there's a series we have coming out early next year on the Super Bowl with Snoop Dogg for Netflix called Coach Snoop. which I'm really proud of. We're wrapping that up right now, and it's all about Snoop. He coaches a inner city youth football team, and the stories of some of those kids are really that we got to tell are really cool because they're 13 years old, 14 years old, not yet men, but not kids anymore. And Snoop can relate to them on the level of how he used to be. So I think you get to see a different side of Snoop Dogg, not the Martha Stewart or game show host. So I'm excited about that. That's coming out around the Super Bowl. It's called Coach Snoop. It's 8 episodes. And as far as future projects, I mean, I don't know. I mean, like I said, when I was in high school, I loved comic books. I loved wrestling. Maybe the trifecta would be if I got to do something on porn. I mean, then I would have every interest I checked off from my high school years. that would be it. Like do something with Jenna Jameson or Ron Jeremy, and then I'll be on my way, and every bucket list will be checked.
Well, I want to thank you for your time here today. Rory Karpf, again, he's the director of Nature Boy, which is a new ESPN 30 for 30 documentary. You can stream it on the ESPN app. You can check it out on ESPN.com. And it is a really, really interesting look at sports and entertainment. So, Rory Karpf, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me in studio. I appreciate it.
And again, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and you are listening to Charlotte Talks.